Continuing with Emanuel Wallerstein. The second part of the tacit agreement was the de facto economic disjuncture of the two zones. The United States would offer no assistance in the reconstruction of the Soviet bloc. Its aid would be limited to its zone. The Marshall Plan in Western Europe, comparable aid to Japan, and later to South Korea and Taiwan in East Asia. U.S. aid to its allies was not simply altruistic philanthropy. It needed customers for its flourishing industries, and reconstructing the economy of these allies made them good customers, as well as faithful political satellites. The Soviet Union, in turn, developed its own regional economic structures, ones that reinforced the autarkic character of the Soviet zone. The third part of the deal was to deny that there was any deal. Each side proclaimed very loudly in its particular language that it was in a total ideological struggle with the other. We came to call this the Cold War. Note, however, that it was and remained to the end a Cold War. The purpose of the very loud rhetoric was not in reality to transform the other, at least not before some very distant moment when the other side would somehow crumble. In this sense, neither side was trying in any immediate time span to win, quote unquote, the war. Each sought rather to oblige its satellites, euphemistically called allies, to toe a very strict political line as dictated by the two superpowers. Neither side would ever support in any meaningful sense rebellious forces within the other camp, since this might lead to the undoing of the primary agreement of a military status quo between the two superpowers. And my comment, i.e., their rule over us, is what is the point and implied by what Emanuel just said, which is straight up Plato. There must be no divisions within the master class. Continuing with Emanuel. Once the military status quo was achieved, the United States could proceed to realize its overall political and cultural dominance in the world system. And I'm pausing because that word cultural just sort of kicked in, and I want to think more about the use of that word given a global system of totalitarianism called class. But continuing, I'm just not sure it's true or accurate is what I'm getting at, what is meant by that word, cultural dominance. Continuing, with its automatic majorities in the United Nations and multiple other transnational institutions, saying that the United States could then, with the military status quo set, go ahead and proceed with its political and cultural ambitions, given its automatic majorities in the United Nations. And I'm thinking that by cultural ambitions, what Emanuel must mean is simply the, because they all ascribe to some degree to the, I guess I would call it the Platonic code of the job of the rulers is to herd the cattle. But what's implied in what he is saying is that these guys are in a competition with each other. I would not call that cultural, but I'm quibbling. Let's continue. With its automatic majorities, the U.S., had automatic majorities in the United Nations and multiple other transnational institutions. The sole exception was in the one agency that controlled military matters, the UN Security Council, where the veto power of each side ensured the military status quo. This arrangement worked very well in the beginning. Then there's this unpredictable force called us. We the people, which is what is rising at the moment. So they are scrambling to readjust. Please, let's not let them. Let us seize this moment. This is our time. Finally, 10,000 years. Don't we deserve our freedom? Come on, people. Come on, let's go. So it worked, this arrangement worked okay at first. And then the way Emmanuel describes us rising is the self-liquidating character of a geo. We got to have a conversation. Emmanuel, I invite you to come as a guest to this show. Come on, let's discuss this self-liquidating self. What would Terry say about this way of describing our always in our always need to rise, our inevitable resistance? Anyway, continuing, the self-liquidating character of a geopolitical quasi-monopoly began to take its toll. The two most significant geopolitical I'm sorry, I'm feeling silly because I'm getting hit so hard. It'll be that way till the date. Haven't we said this? The two most significant geopolitical changes in the two, I guess we can guess what those are, in the two decades following 45 were revolts in the Third World and the economic recovery of Western Europe and Japan. And this is unquote from Emmanuel Wallerstein's chapter, Structural Crisis or Why Capitalists May No Longer Find Capitalism Rewarding. First chapter in Does Capitalism Have a Future? Short answer, no.